Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartztrauber. On today's show, the golden age of surveillance. Should we be talking about how to limit government collection of our data, or is the more important question what they do with that data after they've collected it? Joining me to discuss this is Jake Laparouc, Privacy Fellow at the Constitution Project. Jake, thank you for joining me.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Jake, you've got a new paper out last week titled How a Chain Link Fence Can Protect Privacy in the Age of, quote, Collect It All. And we will link to that paper in the show notes of today's episode. It seems like your premise is that restricting data collection in the first place is not enough to protect privacy in the golden age of surveillance. What do you mean by that?
Right. Well, what we say in the paper is, you know, there's a lot of really important areas where we should try to limit surveillance, limit government collection. You know, ECPA reform, location privacy are a few examples. But the fact is, in a lot of ways, there are just areas that we're not going to be able to stem the tide of private data and sensitive information that's going to the government. So we think it's important that we start looking at different ways that we can actually respond to what happens after the government gets that information. How do they use it? How do they access it? What are the rules? What's the oversight? What are the limits? And we think that by looking at that realm, not just the collection realm, but the areas where it's going to be collected, but what do we do next, is a really important way that we can protect privacy and civil liberties.
And what would you say the problems are with the use of data after they are collected? So, you know, setting aside the problems of whether the collection in the first place violates, you know, Fourth Amendment warrant protections, or whether, you know, national security agencies misinterpreted the Patriot Act, those are all issues about the collection itself. What are the issues with how the data are used after collection?
Well, I think the problems can stem from a few different things. First, you can have issues of if you collect it in a certain way, then maybe it's a problem if you use it in other ways. So one big thing that we talk about a lot is these really intensive military surveillance programs like Section 702 of FISA, Executive Order 12333, which is a Cold War era surveillance executive order. These are really expansive programs that were designed to basically fight the Cold War and fight Al-Qaeda and be a tool for military and intelligence surveillance. That means they're a lot less restricted than, say, your law enforcement warrant that a city cop would use. But if we're going to have those things, then if we don't use them in the manner that we created them, that can create a lot of problems. We also see issues with new technologies. So issues, and this goes to things like location, where maybe we could have some front-end protections, but also things like facial recognition and biometrics, where it might be only more feasible to look at post-collection reforms. You have things like obscurity that have always helped us. Even if you're in public and people can see you, you're technically not in private. You're there, people can see you, but the fact that you're in a crowd of 1,000 people, or that someone sees you like they see 1,000 other people a day, that can actually give you a sort of protection. But if you have these analytical tools like facial recognition that can scan 40 million faces in just 1 second, suddenly that whole protection of obscurity is gone. And we need to start thinking about how we're going to deal with that.
So one of the main issues that you brought up is how data that are collected for national security purposes are used for non-national security purposes. And I think most Americans are okay with, you know, things like Section 702 for the most part and Executive Order 12333 because they might think they don't apply to them, which that's a problematic assumption because, of course, with data being transferred all over the world, just because it's foreign surveillance doesn't mean Americans' data aren't being picked up. But generally, there's a proper role for intelligence. It's important to do counterterrorism and all that stuff. The problem arises when the NSA vacuums up a bunch of data under 12333 on foreigners for whatever purpose, and then they hand that over to local law enforcement. And in the past, there has been this wall, this separation between national security and local law enforcement, which makes sense because whereas local law enforcement should be not be necessarily dealing with foreign threats and foreign surveillance, clearly, that is the NSA's purview, et cetera. Is this wall eroding?
Right. Well, the wall is already gone, and we've been kind of dealing with the implications of that for the last decade and a half. So the wall, it's sort of a formal concept that you hear referenced a lot in the intelligence community and those kind of policy spheres. And it refers to this division between different intelligence community agencies, the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, et cetera, that existed for decades in the past. And it really served two purposes. First of all, it was sort of a check on executive power amongst itself because it separated information between these different agencies, stopped any one agency from becoming too powerful. It's kind of a, you know, important idea that probably arose in the midst of issues with the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover. But it also served a focus of you kept information at these intelligence agencies separate from a law enforcement agency like the FBI or even state and local law enforcement agencies. So it kept national security and military intelligence in that separate realm of the NSA, a military agency, and stopped it from trickling down to becoming a law enforcement tool. Now, after 9/11, the 9/11 Commission, you know, it's a common refrain that we failed to connect the dots. And the issue there, you hear it a lot, even in modern surveillance debates, when we talk about the collected all mentality, is the failure there wasn't even not having information. It was that we didn't connect the dots. We didn't coordinate between agencies. So a big takeaway from that was we need to bring down the wall. And part of the Patriot Act was a big restructuring of the intelligence community that would allow for a lot more sharing of information. The problem was when you took down this wall, that latter purpose might have actually been a good thing. Allow for greater coordination between the intelligence agencies, let them talk to each other, let them share their information. But the other purpose, keeping it out of the hands of law enforcement when you're talking about military intelligence, national security surveillance, that's not something you necessarily want to have in the hands of local law enforcement. It's certainly not something you need to do to remedy that connect the dots problem for the intelligence agencies. So we kind of, in the process of fixing this one problem, created another one by taking down the wall, which was we created a military intelligence surveillance apparatus that is now being used by domestic law enforcement. That's not what we were trying to do after 9/11, but it's something that's been happening ever since then.
Yeah, and of course, information that's obtained for national security purposes could be completely irrelevant to national security. And in theory, that means it should either be discarded or put somewhere safe or just not used. But I guess the problem is when local law enforcement has these military type tools at its disposal, they can use them for things like drug investigations and arson investigations. And we've heard this concern a lot from the privacy community about blurring the lines between national security and law enforcement. Are there particular examples that you know of where local law enforcement has abused this authority? I know there's been a lot of controversy with the way that the NYPD has conducted surveillance on Muslim Americans in New York. What do you see as the biggest problems with law enforcement getting access to national security information?
Right. Well, there are a few examples. One of the more prominent ones is from a couple years ago. There was a Reuters report that the DEA basically has a full unit that's devoted to consuming information from intelligence agencies, from the intelligence community, converting that through a process called parallel construction, sort of recreating it so they could have a fabricated or new version of where they got the information from, and then using that for narcotics investigations. You know, if that's the type of practice that's occurring, it's very hard to say how much it is because the whole purpose is to shield or hide its origin. But I think the biggest threat really is what you look at is the potential use for this, how far it could go. I mean, right now, from what we have heard of investigations by the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board and others, is that the FBI probably mostly does focus on national security, but the authority is there to do whatever they want. So if you look at an authority like 702 FISA and what we know about the FBI's rules and guidelines for how they can use this data that's coming in through this authority that doesn't require any does not require any court authorization to conduct surveillance. They can query data for Americans for any law enforcement purpose. It doesn't have to even be an investigation that's right underway. They could say, I want to query Evan and look to see if he might have committed any federal crime, even if you had no reason or evidence to believe that you had before. They could query someone's name or query keywords related to narcotics or something just to start pulling up as many Americans as they can that exist in that database that there could be some criminal evidence of. So at any point, you know, an FBI director down the road or some other law enforcement investigator down the road could say, we're going to start using this as a key law enforcement tool, and there are no restrictions on that.
Right. And you could see how one major problem would be, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the way I kind of think about parallel construction is where law enforcement gets a bunch of national security information. And in that national security information, they see something that they could prosecute a drug crime. But because the information was obtained through national security, that wouldn't be admissible in court. So what they do is now that they know what guy they're looking for. They saw that, you know, Jake or Evan was related to the investigation. They go through the proper local law enforcement means of getting a warrant, et cetera. But the only reason they knew to look at you in the first place was because of the national security information. So they're basically legitimizing the illegitimate information by going through the warrant requirements after the fact, after they've already kind of improperly been notified about the person.
Yeah, exactly. So there are some restrictions on how you can use 702 data in court. This is from a form from a couple of years ago that OD and I voluntarily adopted, which says we've got 8 classes of crime. They also have this catch-all that says any crime related to national security. Who knows what that means? It's never been defined. But if it's not one of these 8 categories of crimes, we're not going to use it in court. But that doesn't mean, as you just kind of laid out, that you could see this evidence, use it to basically create the foundation for an entire investigation, carry it out, and then use other evidence in court. So you still have a problem there. I mean, if we take a sort of analogous example, you engage in warrantless surveillance at the domestic level compared to at 702, where the law says you can engage in the surveillance without a warrant, you know, that would be considered inadmissible, and all the evidence derived from it would fall under what we call the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine. That means that's inadmissible too. But here we sort of have a loophole around that. You've got all this, what seems to be fruit from the poisonous tree, because there's no warrant to gather to surveil an American, and yet you're taking the product of warrantless surveillance of an American and potentially building an entire investigation on it for a low-level or nonviolent crime.
And is one of the problems here just that law enforcement has these tools at their disposal and they just don't want them to go to waste? Because we've talked on the show before about, you know, a lot of debate over encryption is driven by the drug war, and it's not, you know, people think it's about terrorism, but terrorism is a tiny fraction of the reasons why tech companies run up against law enforcement. There's been mass indiscriminate surveillance before 9/11. You brought up the DEA example from the 90s and later. Is part of the problem here just that they have it and they don't want to let it go to waste?
Well, it's not clear how much it's being wasted, because again, there's just unfortunately very little information about how much this is being used. It brings up another issue with 702 and 12333, which is really how much they're shrouded in shadow. We don't know how many Americans' data is collected under 702. We don't know how often the FBI queries their databases for 702 data. Although we did just find out that the CIA and NSA, the amount of time that they've queried for Americans has doubled from 2 years ago. So clearly it is being used. But I think the more fundamental problem is having this authority that seems susceptible to abuse. Even if right now it's not being used much, even if it's only being used in a proper, responsible, careful manner, if that authority is there and is unrestricted, then we're not going to realize that it's being abused, misused, and taken advantage of until it's too late and until that abuse has already occurred.
So the title of your article mentions the chain link fence rather than having a wall, which you brought up the problems of lack of coordination, the haystack being too big, failing to connect the dots, part of the reason why the 9/11 Commission said we suffered that attack. But of course, just tearing down the wall completely is not necessarily a good solution either, because we've talked about the issue of blurring the lines between law enforcement and national security. So the chain link fence, what does that look like?
Right. So what we're proposing is sort of a middle ground where we can continue to move forward with this idea that we wanted to get rid of the wall, which is share information between intelligence agencies, let them have the full scope of data that they need to respond to national and understand national security threats, but not tear down the wall in a way that means you're going to have this sort of full connection of domestic law enforcement power and military intelligence surveillance. So with the wall fully separated in all ways, that's bad because you don't have any coordination. Now we have no barrier, which means you can kind of have the IC run over into domestic law enforcement land unrestricted and fully plant a flag there. You kind of potentially have the military industrialization of law enforcement surveillance power. And that seems to be problematic for a number of reasons. So what we propose is sort of create a chain link fence that says, yeah, you can sort of slip some information through if you have information related to national security threats, terrorist plots, the purpose that these laws like 702 were created to respond to, then share that information, have some access between the different areas, but you can't have military intelligence agencies running nonstop, unrestricted into the law enforcement sphere and doing whatever they want there.
And of course, getting this question right could be beneficial for non-national security purposes. One of the big issues that comes up around policing with body cameras is what happens with the data? Because of course, in theory, people who are skeptical of the way that law enforcement have treated African-Americans and other minority groups in this country, they're excited about body cameras because it's finally basically bringing to light, putting in public what that community has been experiencing forever. And now they have video proof that police have been mishandling altercations and things like that. But of course, there's this massive surveillance problem. If every single police officer in America basically becomes a walking CCTV camera, what happens to the data that are completely irrelevant to a botched arrest or something like that? And if you get this question right in this instance, similar protections about how data are used and discarded and managed and secured. You know, of course, there's the whole issue of government being hackable and how data can be hacked, whether or not it's being misused. So do you think that if a good regime here, a chain link fence is done properly, that we could see this transferred over to things like the body camera issue and, you know, security cameras, things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, when we talk about it, we're building on where this is a model that seems to be rising up and working in some other areas. So you mentioned hacking. You look at the law CISA, which passed at the end of last year. Very controversial in the privacy and civil liberties community.
It was a cyber information sharing act.
Right. And but it contained one very useful concept, which was use restrictions, the exact same thing we're talking about. And the idea for that was sometimes you might have content or metadata sensitive information shared as a cyber threat. Well, if you're sharing it as a cyber threat, law enforcement shouldn't be able to use it for whatever they want. They should use it for cybersecurity. So that, plus a few other exceptions, was included in the law. Now, there was a lot of parsing about how strong those exceptions should be. But the main concept there, the idea that if you're sharing this information, the government's getting access to the information for one select purpose under lower standards, then you have to get a warrant to get a court order for this information, then we should be limiting how the government can use it. That's something that we should be taking to other areas. And you hear a lot of refrains sometimes from government officials or from the intelligence community. Oh, well, it's unprecedented or unimaginable that data that we've lawfully collected that we can't do whatever we want with it. I mean, there are plenty of examples, and that's just one to show. No, that's, we take the case that we limit how the government should use data based on how it's collected in a lot of ways. You have things like CISA, you have restrictions are for drug treatment through Health and Human Services. You have minimization right now in 702. It's not very strong. Hopefully it can get changed. But the basic concept that the government is required to minimize data that is collected through 702 shows false, the idea that once the government has lawfully collected, it's all free game for them. So I think it's a concept that definitely has a history and definitely is pretty commonly accepted, but something we should look to expand and grow on.
So to wrap up, this paper is particularly timely because the White House and the Office of Director of National Intelligence had announced, I guess, a couple months ago that they were going to further tear down the wall, that data collected through Executive Order 12333, which is ostensibly foreigner-to-foreigner communication but still can wrap up Americans in that, would be shared with local law enforcement. That doesn't look like a chain link fence. Do you see them changing that, or has there been a positive reception to your proposal? Where do you see this going in the future?
Right. Well, that's definitely another concerning area. And 12333 is interesting because the government actually somewhere recently they put up a small portion of the chain link fence in one area in Presidential Policy Directive 28, which was I think from early 2015. That says that for data collected in bulk, okay, without a target, surveillance through Executive Order 12333, it can only be used for six specific reasons. And those are things like cybersecurity, terrorism, mostly national security-related threats. So common law enforcement use of that type of information is currently prohibited. That seems like the exact sort of idea that we want for the chain link fence. Let the information be shared and used for these select purposes for which you are collecting it, but don't allow free reign for any type of thing. But keep in mind that that's only for bulk collection. There's a lot of targeted collection that can occur under 12333 where you have a specific target that could still sweep up Americans who are especially vulnerable to unchecked surveillance power being used by law enforcement down the road. So, that's an area where as the type of collection that's occurring is expanding, as the sharing between government agencies is expanding, it becomes all the more important to say, we have to find reasonable restrictions on how you can access this data and how you can use it.
Well, this is certainly an issue that's not going away. As I mentioned, those changes to 12333 are coming, and the privacy community is sounding the alarm and letting people know that there should be a separation between law enforcement and national security. The lines cannot be blurred too much. And today, my guest was Jake LaPerouc, privacy fellow at the Constitution Project, who proposes a chain link fence as a way of allowing the agencies to share what they need without letting national security information be used for improper purposes. Jake, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
His paper is titled How a Chain Link Fence Can Protect Privacy in the Age of Collect It All. It is linked to in the show notes for today's episode. Let us know what you think of the show on Twitter at TechFreedom or on Facebook.com/TechFreedom. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Pitch your favorite guests on the show or let us know what topics you want to hear. Find this podcast in the iTunes store. Please leave us a review. It would help others find the show. And thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.